Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of historian Ruth Frager's talk, Spadina Sweatshops, Jews and Gender in Toronto's Labor Movement, 1900 to 1939. It is part of the 2012 History Matters lecture series, sponsored by the Toronto Public Library and the History Education Network. Please check back on ActiveHistory.ca in the near future for recordings of subsequent talks from the 2012 History Matters lecture series.
They tried to keep that low, then if you were sick and couldn't work, you something in return to help tide you over. There are also other kinds of things. People could seek assistance for other reasons of unemployment as well. And eventually what we see is that the clothing unions also served as social and cultural centers. And I'll talk more about them in a few minutes. Part of the reason that Jews were so concentrated residentially, that is in terms of where they were living, has to do partly with the whole religious organization. You can imagine that if you needed to have kosher meat, you would need to live among Jews. And for Orthodox Jewish men, the injunction was to pray 3 times a day in the company of at least 9 other Jewish males. There are many other kinds of issues here that reinforce this notion of Jews clumping together in the New World. It was not allowed, if you were Orthodox, to ride on the Sabbath. So if you were going to a synagogue, you needed to live where you could walk to one, in particular. There are also, in this period, secular Jews who still see themselves as very much Jewish, but are not religious in this period, and they eat kosher meat, nonetheless. And they, again, were wanting to live amongst other Jews so that they could speak Yiddish to neighbors and to shopkeepers, so that they could buy kosher foods, attend the Yiddish theaters, and so forth. So I can talk about reasons why Jews themselves wanted to live amongst each other, but there are also other constraints. And that has to do with local anti-Semitism in this period. There were many landlords who would not rent to Jews, and there are a number of other racialized groups to whom they would not rent either. And there are also restrictive covenants. So this meant that even if a Jewish immigrant family had money, there were places where, right in the deed to particular houses, it would say that this house cannot be sold to people from the following groups. And that included Jews, included certain groups such as Polish Catholics. As you can imagine, it included people of African heritage. I actually live near McMaster, so I'm going to jump in Hamilton for a moment. I live in Westdale, which was a planned community which was set up in the 1930s. And it had these restrictive covenants deliberately. And those covenants were not actually made illegal until the 1950s in Ontario. Okay, so these are some of the reasons why Jews concentrated residentially. Although ironically, they're also being stereotyped negatively in a number of ways, and partly with the idea that they just congregate together. That was seen by the members of the host society as a bad thing. Even though, ironically, part of this was because of the kind of anti-Semitism that they were facing. And also, of course, economic constraints. Many of these Jewish immigrants were quite impoverished, and that's partly why they were coming to certain parts of the city. So let me just show you a map. You know what? I forgot to get my laser pointer. Wait, you know what? I can manage without it. I can just do the old-fashioned pointer. Okay. Okay, I can handle this. So, here's a map of the ward. And for some of you who can't see the fine print, what we're looking at is this pale area. So we're on Queen Street here, Cartland College up here, and then University and Yonge. And this is a very poor area of the city, in the central district. And many immigrants congregated there, especially the Jewish immigrants upon whom I'm focusing. Now, as more Jewish immigrants are coming in, they're moving over here to Spadina, which comes along here, again, between College and Queen. And as more garment factories and contractors and subcontractors in the sector are opening up, they're also often in the Spadina area. So the area we're in right now, not by coincidence either. Okay. Now, I was mentioning that the ward was quite an impoverished area, and I do want to show you just a few slides of some of the poverty there, but I'll have to be very brief. You can see from some of this what kind of fire traps some of these places would have been. You can see garbage strewn about where kids would be playing. You can imagine how cold it would be in the winter in these kinds of places as well. Inadequate sanitary facilities. There are also basement apartments. So issues of poor ventilation, poor lighting, and so forth, damp basements, and so forth. These are some of the things that I just wanted to show you briefly. The slide that I started out with was a shot of a smaller sweatshop in the clothing industry. We also in this period have quite a mix, and there are large clothing factories, so I just want to put one of those slides up there to set the context. Now, what I want to do then is talk about some of the reasons for occupational concentration. In other words, if you look at what kinds of jobs, that is in terms of the paid labor force, what kinds of jobs immigrant Jews held in this period, you would see a very high proportion of them concentrated in the clothing industry. And there are a number of reasons for this. I mean, some are doing other things. There are Jewish peddlers, for example, small shopkeepers, but many were in the clothing industry in this period. And it's the clothing industry then that became the basis for the Jewish labor movement. So this is a labor-intensive industry. It's not the kind of industry where there are huge machines and less of a need for so many human beings. It's labor-intensive. There are many hands literally needed in this sector. And it's providing a lot of jobs. In fact, as far as I can tell, in the early 1900s, the clothing industry provided the most jobs of any sector in Toronto in this period, far changed from now. It provided jobs for men, but it's also significant because it provided jobs for women. And as you can imagine, this is a period where job opportunities for women were very, very limited. There's so many jobs that are coded as for men and women. It's also provided jobs for children. Now, there's a movement to make child labor illegal, and this is succeeding more by the 1920s, but there are also ways of getting around this. And one of the people I interviewed, he was in his 80s at the time, but he had been working in Toronto in the garment factories for a long time earlier. And he told me about the 1920s when he was an underage child, in other words, below the legal limit where he could work. But when an inspector would come around, which I can't imagine would be very often, someone would quickly run and tell him, and then he would dive under a pile of clothing, so very straightforward in a way. You can imagine, I mean, there's lots of piles of clothing, parts of vests lying around, bolts of cloth, and so forth. Another reason that Jews were so concentrated in this sector is that many of them had already been working as tailors in the old country. And this is partly because of severe anti-Semitic restrictions. In Tsarist Russia, Jews could not own land, they were not supposed to be farmers, and they were barred from many occupations. So we have a situation where many who are coming over are already in this sector, and then others who are coming over without a trade but needing work are sometimes coming to this sector because there are others they know who can teach them. There are others who can help them find a job nearby. They have relatives. I mean, some of these people are working for a brother or an uncle. That's very common in this period in particular. There also, another reason that Jews are concentrating here is something that you may not be familiar with, and that is that there's a religious injunction in the Hebrew Bible against wearing clothing that mixed wool and linen. So in effect, clothing had to be kosher. And this meant that Jews who were truly observant, religious, had to depend on Jewish-made clothing to ensure that this mix was not in the clothing in particular. And when we look at occupational restrictions here, there were many factory jobs that were absolutely closed to Jews. Employers simply would not hire them. And sometimes the employers would say, well, maybe I would hire you, but you know, then those other people would not work with you, so I can't do that. So there are these kinds of pressures as well. This is a sector where there are some jobs that aren't that skilled. I mean, it looks very skilled to me, sewing looks very skilled to me, but in this period, of course, there are many, many women, especially in girls, who have these kinds of skills. And so for someone who didn't have a trade, who needed a job fast, this was a way to get a job, to learn very quickly and take some of the least skilled jobs in this sector. And you can imagine that religious Jews would want to work for Orthodox Jews because they want to make sure they don't have to work on the Sabbath in particular. There's one other thing I just thought I'd mention briefly, and that is the whole issue of people with entrepreneurial hopes in particular. The sector is a sector where if you want to set up your own sort of small factory contracting shop, you rent a few sewing machines, you don't have to lay out a lot of cash. So it's a sector where some people went into it hoping that after working for a while they would have enough experience, that they might be able to save enough money, and then they would be able to open up their own small clothing factory. And some of these are in people's homes, which in some ways leads me to my next point, which is that the conditions, as you can imagine, were sometimes quite horrific. We're talking about a seasonal industry. We all know about seasonal demand for clothing in terms of the retail side. What this means is that in factories, there are real peaks in terms of workload. And during those seasonal peaks, some people I interviewed talked about sleeping in these tiny sweatshops. The idea is that they were working so long, they had to get there really early, they were working so long into the night that they just slept there on piles of cloth and clothing, and that this would go on. So it's a tough kind of job in that sense, because you have these huge seasonal peaks where you have to work extremely long hours, sometimes 16 hours a day. And also, we're looking at a situation where then there appears unemployment when there's not the same rush to make that kind of clothing for a particular season. So we're looking at difficult work conditions, very low wages, seasonal unemployment. And we certainly have a whole series of labor newspapers, like organizers and so forth, condemning these kinds of conditions. But in order to sound more objective, I'll tell you about a couple of other condemnations, okay? So, William Lyon Mackenzie King, long before he became prime minister, wrote a report as an investigative journalist for the Toronto Daily Morning Empire. And he investigated a lot of these sweatshops that made clothing. And he wrote this report about what he saw as pitifully low wages, extremely long hours of work. And he also was very concerned about poor ventilation, especially if we go back before electricity, for the irons that were used to press the clothing. These would be powered by gas. And so Mackenzie King was particularly concerned about these apartments that were turned into workshops where there's very little ventilation and all these fumes as well. There are also problems with speed-ups during the seasonal peaks and other kinds of health hazards. I'll cite another expert to get you more of a sense of this. We're going to zoom forward to 1935 for a moment. There's a federal commission, a Royal Commission on Price Rates, as it was called. And it did a lot of investigation of a number of things. But part of the investigation was to look at the plight of female clothing workers in Toronto in particular. And in a report that the commission issued, the commission said that the wages and working conditions in this sector, and this is a short quote, merit the most emphatic condemnation. So the commissioners themselves were shocked. And the good thing for the historian is that the testimony survives. The commissioners would have witnesses appear before them, and you can get the transcripts of those interviews. So I want to just quote a couple of these interviews from the report. So we're in 1935. Both of these people I want to quote very briefly were women who were working at one of the better clothing factories and nonetheless had much to complain about, as we'll see. In fact, they were working in the clothing factories of the TEE Company in Toronto. So one of them talked about, she was telling the commissioners, that the speed-ups were so harsh that, and here's the quote, I would go home nights and I would be so tired I could not eat myself. And I would be so tired and stiff going home on the streetcar, I would just dread getting a seat. Because if I sat down, I could not get up again. My knees and my legs would be so stiff. Okay, one comment. One of her co-workers, who also testified before the Royal Commissioners, had actually had nervous breakdowns and had to be hospitalized. And she basically said, well, you had to work so hard, you were driven so fast, you were a nervous wreck. There are other kinds of problems if we're focusing on health hazards. High blood pressure, skin irritations and boils have to do with chemicals in the cloth. And also, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the idea that there's something called the Taylor's disease, and that's tuberculosis. It was actually known as the Taylor's disease in this period. So, we have a pretty bad situation here, and many of the Jewish garment workers responded militantly to try to develop unions, to try to struggle for better pay, in some cases, better health conditions, including better ventilation, to try to regulate the hours of work, and so forth. Sometimes they mounted dramatic strikes, even though this is a period where there's a great deal of hostility to unions, as you can perhaps imagine. The police often sided with employers who were against unions. The courts often aided anti-union employers, not just in this sector, but in many as well. I was mentioning that some of those who worked in this sector did not really have scarce skills, and so they're very vulnerable. If an employer heard that they were talking about a union or a protest, they could be fired and replaced with other workers. So they're in a very vulnerable position. And it's also a period where it's very difficult for Jewish workers to forge alliances with non-Jewish clothing workers as well. I wanted to talk a bit about the activism that's rooted in working class immigrant Jewish culture in this period. This is a situation where we're talking about not simply trade unionism, Jordan Simple. It's a phrase that's used to refer to concentrating on concrete shop floor issues. As I was mentioning a few minutes ago, these unions were also serving important social functions as well. And they also, in this period, were explicitly socialist in orientation, in particular. Now, the main unions, and one I'll be talking more about, is the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, known by its initials as the ILGWU. The title can be a bit misleading. It means the people made ladies' clothing. Okay? So it's women and men who made ladies' clothing. That's one union. And the other one is the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union, and that tends to focus on women and men who made men's clothing in particular. Now, these were known as the Jewish unions here and also in New York and a number of other places where there were clothing centers, although they were striving to take in non-Jewish clothing workers as well. But they were often led by Jews, and many of the rank and filers were Jews as well. The main leaders were men, but there were some women playing very militant roles, especially Jewish women. And here what I wanted to do was highlight the sensibility of some of these people who had come over from Eastern Europe and felt themselves oppressed as Jews and also as workers. So when I interviewed people who were in their 80s, who had worked in the garment industry in the 1920s and 1930s, this was a while ago, they talked to me about what radicalized them in particular. And when we look at Jewish socialists, we're looking at a situation where ethnic consciousness in particular and class identity reinforced each other in particular. So I wanted to talk to you a bit about one person I interviewed. He was born in Poland, where he was a tailor. His name was Saul Abel. And he was already radicalized and already experienced as a union organizer in the sector when he came. And as a youngster in Poland, Saul Abel joined the Bund in rebellion against the difficult times that Jews were forced, the difficult lives that Jews were forced to lead there. He said that Polish anti-Semitism was the number one reason why he became a Bundist. He was not a Zionist, and he believed that the Bund's idea of a decentralized form of socialism would be the best for Jews and for people whom he saw as oppressed as workers as well. So the idea is that Jews would be able to preserve their own culture within multi-ethnic socialist federations. So for him then, the idea of socialism is that it's a promise of a new society where everyone, including Jews, especially including Jews for him, would be equal. I spoke to another person who came over when she was a bit younger. She was radicalized here. She too was from Poland, and she stressed when I talked to her that she had been radicalized as a Jew. I'll give you a quotation from her. "I joined the communist movement for the reason that at that time we thought that the best solution for the Jew is in the Soviet Union. That was right after the revolution. And I joined for that reason, that I wanted my people should be equal with every other people." She's also interesting, and I wanted to mention her to you, because she was one of these women who had very heavy household responsibilities. She became a wife and a mother. And she was working to earn money for her family as a cloak maker, as making women's coats. And she also devoted herself to building the union in her trade. in her particular section of the clothing industry, and also building the Jewish branch of the Communist Party of Canada in particular. She was one of those who left in the mid-1950s, but that's a whole other story, and I'm going to leave it brief. Okay. Another thing to say is that some of the people that I interviewed talked to me about how many of these who became socialists were no longer religious, but talked to me about how their religious childhoods had influenced their ideological orientation. One in particular talked to me about the writings of Amos and Isaiah, where they talk about the need to relieve the oppressed, especially the poor, and to break the yoke of oppression and to seek justice. So we're looking at a situation where class consciousness and ethnic identity were so central, they were shaping the politics of the Jewish labor movement, even though class issues were divisive within the Jewish community, because we're entering a period, especially in the interwar period, where more of the clothing manufacturers and contractors and subcontractors were Jewish. So this becomes divisive in ways that I want to focus on in a moment. Ethnic issues also function divisively within the working class, tensions between Jewish and non-Jewish workers. But the people I spoke to and the sources, the printed sources I looked at as well, really stressed these two factors in terms of class consciousness and ethnic identity. What I haven't seen, in terms of people I talked to, especially those who were radical in other ways, what I did not see was a commitment to women's rights. And my sense of this was that that was not developing because that was partly because that was seen as too divisive in terms of the Jewish community and in terms of the working class as well. And if we're looking at Jewish working class activism, I'll be focusing mainly on the garment sector, but there are other things going on as well. There are Jewish school children occasionally mounting strikes against anti-Semitic teachers, which I find quite fascinating. And there are also consumer boycotts by Jewish housewives. And these aren't boycotts, there's a whole series of them, both in Toronto and Montreal. And these are boycotts that are against when the prices of kosher food goes up, or when they consider it too high. So again, these are actually battles within the community. So these are women who eat kosher meat, but were in the hundreds massing to protest the prices from the Jewish butcher shops in particular. But some of the conflicts within the Jewish community, some of the greatest conflicts were between Jewish workers and Jewish manufacturers in the clothing sector in particular. And I was mentioning to you before that some of these people could be relatives, close relatives. Some of them would be neighbors, members of the same synagogues, or perhaps members of the same mutual aid societies as well. And there were Jewish workers who were reluctant to strike against relatives, as you can imagine. But this is a sector where strikes broke out fairly frequently. There are also Jewish employers who sometimes made key concessions out of sympathy with the workers. But there were also complaints that Jewish manufacturers were doing things that, in fact, were promoting anti-Semitism as a way of restraining militancy amongst the workers. The Yiddish newspaper in Toronto was left-wing, socialist in its orientation, and pro-union. And the editorials would address strike issues when there were significant strikes. And sometimes the report was that there were manufacturers, Jews and non-Jews, who were stirring up anti-Semitism in order to try to keep the non-Jewish workers away from Jewish militant unions in particular. And as you can imagine, the Yiddish newspaper condemned this, and also argued that it's the manufacturers who should make concessions, not the workers. So very interesting their take on this in this newspaper. The idea, the concern, is partly that public fighting among Jews will increase anti-Semitism. And so the newspaper's editors are saying, we all know that's a problem, so the manufacturers should make concessions in particular. At the same time, there are these tensions. On the one hand, I've been focusing on these kinds of divisions within the Jewish community, in Toronto in particular, similar dynamics in Montreal. But there are also, as you can imagine, real forces pushing them together. In fact, I was starting out by talking about why they're living together, that kind of residential concentration. And when I looked at the pages of the Yiddish newspaper, well before the rise of fascism in the 1930s, every page of that newspaper for Toronto is very concerned with anti-Semitism, both back in Eastern Europe, especially in Eastern Europe, and still anti-Semitism in Canada as well, although it's obviously not anywhere near as violent. So there are communities where these Jewish communities had quite a sense of needing to stick together, and at the same time, this sense that nonetheless there are certain tensions that are sometimes quite dramatic. So what I want to do then is to focus in particular on this one strike at the T. Eaton Company's garment factories in Toronto. And it gives us a chance to look at this somewhat more concretely, to look at relations between Jewish workers and non-Jewish workers in these Eaton factories, to look at relations between male and female workers, and to look at broader issues having to do with public sympathy for labor causes and issues around anti-Semitism there as well. So let me go to another slide. It's kind of ironic now because many people aren't aware that the T. Eaton Company had huge retail stores. But they had more than that. And if we're looking at the early 1900s, this is quite huge. It was a major employer, not just a real retail department store, but also clothing factories, and that one on the right there, it also talks about stables and so forth. So that slide is, on the right is at Yonge and Queen, and on the left is a photo from the 1910s of the garment factory. I'll just show you some of these images of people working at the T. Eaton Company in particular. And what's happening here is that in the winter of 1912, over 1,000 workers from the company's clothing factory walked off the job over a dispute in one of the women's clothing departments. About a third of the strikers were women, and the strike also spread to the men's clothing departments as well. And so the strikers were now locked in combat with one of the most powerful employers in the country. It's hard to envision that now, but this was the case. And the causes of the strike go back to things that I've been talking about already in terms of low wages, long hours, speed ups, unsanitary conditions, and so forth. In 1912, I believe that the Eaton clothing factory was the largest in the country, and most of the clothing workers there were Jews. Now, management was on the lookout for anybody who was organizing protests or trying to organize a union. But nonetheless, the ILGWU, the union if that was involved specifically with those who made women's clothing, was quietly organizing them. And in terms of the causes of this strike, there are a number of issues. The union charged that, in this brief quote, frail children of 14 years in busy seasons worked from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. The union also objected to what they called graft for foreman. In other words, this is piecework rather than an hourly wage, and so if you get a certain amount of money for sewing together a vest, the idea is that if you do favors for the supervisor, then he'll throw you the easiest vests to sew. Something else here, I used to wonder how issues of sexual harassment were dealt with when that term is so new. But what they're calling it during the strike is insults to girls. Gives you some sense of that. So the strike started in terms of its immediate cause when management ordered 65 male sewing machine operators to sew in the linings of women's coats on their sewing machines. And the men refused to do this. And there are two issues here. One is this is extra work for the men without extra pay. The men had been doing the work getting 65 cents per garment without sewing in the linings. And now they're being asked to also sew in the linings, no extra pay. And sewing in the linings had been done by women who were doing that work by hand. So this meant that if the men took on this work, it would be a problem in terms of the men's pay, but it also meant women would lose their jobs. So the 65 male sewing machine operators sat down in protest and refused to work. After several days of this, the administration fired them and physically threw them out onto the street. And at that point, over 1,000 clothing workers from Eaton's joined them in particular. And part of what I find fascinating about this strike is it provides an example of men going out on strike where they're talking specifically about women's interests. I can find quite a lot of strikes where men and women go out on strike together in this period. We're looking at the clothing industry in Toronto. But very seldom do I find some specific kind of demand that focuses specifically on women. And this is because, as you can imagine, the idea here was that men were the natural and rightful breadwinners, and therefore they should be the ones to have the better jobs and the better pay. One of the men I interviewed actually was not old enough to have been around during the Eaton strike, but he told me about the way in which it had sort of survived as a legend. And he said that the Jewish activists were proud that one of their first big strikes had been in defense of, quote unquote, our sisters. And I'll give you his words for a moment. And this is how he explained this. The reasoning of the men who worked at Eaton's was a simple one, that these women workers will lose their jobs. And maybe the men felt they didn't want to do these jobs that the women are now doing. Maybe the men's wages will come down if the men were to sew in the linings by machine. Because the rates fixed for those operations were always traditionally lower because women did those operations. I never rule out the element of selfishness and self-interest, which is also human. I find it a very interesting strike because male and female interests coincided in this way. And one of the strike slogans was, translated from Yiddish, "We will not take the morsel of bread from the mouths of our sisters." Here I want to show you my favorite photograph. So, just to remind you, the ILGWU then was the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, the main union involved in the strike. One thing I wanted to highlight is if you look down here, it's very hard to make out, but this newspaper is called Jack Canuck. I just want to tell you it's there because I want to talk about it in a couple of minutes. Okay? So, we're looking at a situation where people who went out on strike tended to be those who were Jews. And the non-Jewish clothing workers at Eaton's didn't join the strike. And what the labor newspapers were reporting, particularly the ILGWU's newspaper, was that there were efforts being made to cut off sympathy for the strikers by saying this is only a strike of Jews. And also, Eaton's was very powerful and brought in young English girls, young women who were English from England itself, and brought them in as strike writers in particular. Now, the Jewish strikers did receive certain forms of support. They received wide support within the Jewish community, within the immigrant Jewish community in particular. The Association of Hebrew Charities provided food for the strikers. Local Jewish women's organizations took up street collections to provide funding for the strike until they were stopped by city authorities in particular. And the attempt was to reinforce the strike by calling for a boycott of Eaton's goods. But this was a problem. There were certain people who boycotted Eaton's, but the boycott was not as successful as had been hoped. The strikers did receive some support from the Toronto Trades and Labour Council, which was the central organization, the umbrella organization for the unions in the city. The other unions did raise money for these strikers in particular, and they helped promote a national boycott of Eaton's. But what I find particularly curious is that many of those who supported the strike, many of these allies, not the strikers themselves, did so despite the fact that the strikers were Jewish. There was anti-Semitism involved even among some of those who supported the strike in particular. Let me go to Jack Knuck. His newspaper was supporting the boycott in particular. This is a populist newspaper, and I'm not quite tall enough, but way up there it says bargains, and you can see in that circle there are women who are ostensibly clamoring to get into Eaton's to buy clothing on the cheap. But this is basically saying, give us this day our daily bread, and this is the kind of worker who's being totally worn out by having to make that clothing so that Eaton's can sell it very cheaply. So this newspaper, Jack Knopf, was supporting the strikers, but at the same time, it was also making comments at the very same time against Jews in particular. So talking about Jews as dirty and the dirtiest specimen, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going through all the quotes in particular. So what's going on here is partly that there's a current of hostility to Eaton's because it's a department store. And the idea is that, from a populist point of view, Eaton's and other department stores are doing bad things in this city and other places because they're squeezing out the small shopkeepers. And so it's partly in that context that these Jewish strikers receive some unexpected support in particular. It's a bit like some of the reservations about Walmarts today, where people argue those kinds of things, that they're squeezing out local businesses and so forth. So we do see that. One other thing I wanted to highlight, although I'll have to be very brief, but so Jack Canuck, the newspaper, was portraying the TE company as a kind of octopus that was reaching out everywhere and doing these bad things, and focusing particularly on John Eaton. And one article scathingly declared that John Eaton, and here's a brief quote, gives immense amounts of money to hospitals and other institutions to take care of the sick and indigent, and apparently tries very hard to keep these institutions supplied with patients by overworking and And I have one other slide to show you, which also is one of my favorite. There's a lot going on in here. So it's Jack Canuck, and you can see that it says it stands for truth and justice, however it perceives those. Okay, so this is supposed to be John Eaton, the philanthropist. I'm not sure if you can make this out. The factory's padlocked, so this goes back to the idea that the 65 workers were originally locked out. So some of the protesters are saying this is not really a strike, it's a lockout. And so the argument here is that he's posing as a philanthropist, but he's locking the workers out. And over here they're saying, you know, all we ask is work, if you don't have work, we'll starve. And over here, he's trying to, this is labeled a tea company, so you know I'm talking about the right guy here. And he's trying to you know, create more fame for himself by donating all this money. And over here it says, let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth. So it gives you some sense of the way in which Jack Canuck was painting this. There are other aspects of the strike. There were attempts to get suffrage organizations, that's organizations that were supporting votes for women, to sympathize with the women strikers and support the boycott. But very little of that came across. There's very little support, as far as I can tell, among suffragists. And basically what's happening here, and I'll end here because I've gone on for too long, I think, basically they're no match for such a powerful employer. Strikers are having trouble holding out, so there's no strike pay or anything like that. As I mentioned, Eaton's was bringing in strike breakers all the way from England. And when the strike ended, strikers had to give in, it was a boycott of Jewish workers. And for a very long time, the TE company would not hire Jews in the clothing factory. Certainly wouldn't hire them to work in the retail clubs either, in any case. And the company recovered so quickly from this that it had plans the very next year to set up a whole new factory building.
You've been listening to a recording of Ruth Frager's talk, Spadina Sweatshops, Jews and Gender in Toronto's Labor Movement, 1900 to 1939. It's part of the 2012 History Matters lecture series sponsored by the Toronto Public Library and the History Education Network. Please check back on activehistory.ca in the near future for recordings of subsequent talks from the 2012 History Matters lecture series.